After my last two sermons, which touched on stillbirth and suffering and conflict and grief, I plan to preach something a bit gentler tonight. Perhaps something a little bit funny or a little bit playful, or drawing on the Song of Songs, of course, a little bit sexy. And then during the week, I had a flurry of conversations, five to my count, about sexual abuse and sexual assault. And then I read the text from Mark. In this story, religious leaders criticised Jesus' followers for failing to wash their hands in the correct ritual way before eating. And Jesus pushes back hard, and he goes on to say that we're not made impure by failing to keep kosher. Instead, it's our destructive desires and behaviours which render us unclean. In our context today, there are many ways to read or interrogate the text. Most of us don't have issues with eating pork or prawns per se. But in a world of industrialised farming and animal feedlots, dwindling fish stocks and toxic agricultural runoffs, questions around purity of food and water and land and consumers have become pressing once again. You only have to look at food labels to see how important the idea of purity has become. Things are organic and fair trade and made in Australia, biodynamic, raw, and in my area, wild harvested, gleaned and local, and so on. And so food purity is certainly one lens through which we could explore the text. But with this week's conversations ringing in my ears, I began to think about other areas of life where we use the language of purity and defilement. Other factors that can exclude people from religious gatherings, and other experiences that can make it hard for people to believe that they belong to the body of Christ. In other words, I began to wonder what would happen if Jesus wasn't talking about keeping kosher, but about sexual assault. So I want to tell the story again, but in a new way. I've warned a couple of you, and if it becomes too confronting, any one of you is welcome to slip out at any time and grab a cuppa instead, kitchens that way, instead of listening to the sermon. But to those who stay, I invite you to sit back and trust me. I'm telling you a story. When the bishops and the senior pastors came and spent some time with him, they soon noticed that some of his followers were homosexual. Some of the men were flamboyantly gay, and some of the women were clearly partners. They realised too that many of the disciples had had sex before marriage. Some among the disciples had never married, but they were living together and sharing beds. Others had been divorced and repartnered, and some of them had divorced again. Some had had children with multiple husbands or with multiple wives, and some were raising children alone. Many of the lesbians had children, and some of those children were being raised by two lesbian mothers and a gay male father, or by some other arrangement of adults. So the bishops and the senior pastors asked him, "Why don't your people live out biblical family values? They have sex before marriage, and some of them aren't even married but are living together anyway. Many of your people have had multiple partners and some of them engage in homosexual acts, which according to Leviticus is an abomination. Moreover, some of the children don't spend time with their fathers. And whoever heard of a child having two mothers?" At the time that they were asking these questions, there was a royal commission into institutional responses to child sexual abuse going on in the land. Behind closed doors, women and men described how they'd been sexually assaulted by religious officials. Some survivors explained that they hadn't told anyone because their parents had such a high view of religious officials that their stories would never be believed. Some described how the abuse had affected them. They began to think that they'd brought it on themselves and that they were somehow evil and to be blamed. Some described the suicides of friends and classmates. or the way they felt trapped by spirals of self-harm and addiction. Many survivors suffered from mental illness, and many survivors were poor. Doubts about their self-worth led some into relationships with violent and abusive partners, who demanded that they engage in degrading sexual practices. Many survivors felt dirty and defiled by the things that had been done to them. And years after the abuse, many still felt this way. The Royal Commission was also hearing from institutions. Gradually, it pieced together a pattern of denial and even complicity in the abuse. It learnt that offenders were rarely disciplined, but instead were moved on. It found that some parishes had been sent many offending priests in a row, so that grandparents, parents, and children had all been abused. There were allegations of a paedophile ring, and contemporary senior religious officials were implicated. Widespread abuse had rent the social fabric of several nearby cities and towns, and the effects were still being seen many, many years later. The religious officials denied all wrongdoing. Even those who were sentenced to prison showed little or no remorse. And senior religious officials stood by the offenders and supported them during their trials. Legal attempts at restitution or recompense were fought tooth and nail. Some survivors were pushed into in-house processes, which required them to sign a deed of release in return for meagre compensation. Others ended up in protracted legal proceedings. Religious institutions spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on legal advice and representation, and let defence lawyers guide their policies and their actions. Powerful religious officials used their access to the media to mock survivors' groups and to make personal attacks on the psychologists and the lawyers who represented the victims. And it was into this context that the bishops and the senior pastors asked, "Why don't your people live out biblical family values?" And he said to them, "Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites. As it's written, this people pays me lip service, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain, for they teach human commandments as doctrine. You abandon the commandment of God and wield human tradition like a sword." And then he said, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. For as the prophet said, you must care for the widow, the orphan, and the refugee, all those who have no one to protect them. But you spout family values and say, anyone who has sex before marriage or gets divorced or is in a homosexual relationship cannot be part of the kingdom of heaven. You force people to lie about their relationships or to suppress sexual expressions of faithful love. And yet you take no responsibility for the structures that enable sexual violence against women and children. Instead, you've protected religious officials and worried about your own status." Then he called the crowd again and he said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile you. Nothing that anyone has done to you can defile you. No way that they've touched you can defile you. No act of sexual degradation, no act of violence, no scene of pornography that's been forced upon you can make you unclean in my eyes. There is nothing, there is absolutely nothing that another person can do to you that can make you unfit for communion with me. The only thing that can get in the way of communion with me is using other people to satisfy your own desires and failing to live in love. You might feel defiled by what other people have done to you, But in my eyes, you are not defiled. You are not defiled.